for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Sonia Sotomayor and the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee meet for what may be her final day of questioning. The first Latina nominated to the Supreme Court has so far deflected questions about controversial statements she's made, as well as her temperament on the bench. Joining me in the studio to talk about the confirmation hearings, USA Today's Supreme Court reporter Joan Biskupic, Marcia Greenberger with the National Women's Law Center, and the National Journal, Stuart Taylor. And I look forward to hearing your questions and comments this morning as we talk about the confirmation hearings that have gone on this week. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can reach us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you. It's been a busy week.
Good morning.
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 Joan Biskupic, what part of the confirmation hearings are we in now?
We're in the final phases of the questioning by senators of Judge Sotomayor. She's been on for 3 days now, but only the 2 days for a Q&A. And right now, the senators are each in their second round, getting 20 minutes apiece to ask any kind of follow-up questions from Tuesday and Wednesday. That I expect to go to early this afternoon, depending on mostly Republicans and how much more they want to probe. And then we will have outside witnesses. There are a slew of witnesses that will be called by the majority of the committee and also by the minority Republican members that could finish up tonight, or it could go into Friday. And then we're essentially done with the committee business, although committee members do have the option to ask other questions that she would respond to in writing.
How soon would you expect the committee to vote on confirmation?
I would think it wouldn't happen next week, but probably the following week. And this is why. The committee could technically, in some ways, vote next week because it's heard all this testimony. But the Republicans have the option to hold it over a week. And I would think that given that she has a 17-year record, given that they don't want to seem as if they're just, you know, opening the door for President Obama's first appointee, and that they have some serious questions, they might want it held over one more week. I do not think there will be any issue at this point to her winning confirmation, barring anything surprising happening in the next couple days, by the first week in August when the senators recess for the summer.
Joan, what would you say have been the most contentious or the most controversial parts of the hearing?
Well, I would say there are three issues that have dominated in terms of controversy, and that's the reverse discrimination allegations from the New Haven, Connecticut firefighters case, issues of abortion, and then I'd say issues over the Second Amendment right to firearms and the Supreme Court's ruling on that in 2008 and how she interpreted it with a panel decision earlier this year. I have to say, though, Diane, we haven't really seen exactly how she feels about all these issues, how she would rule once she were on the Supreme Court, because she's been quite masterful in deflecting a lot of these questions. But those have been the more substantive issues that have played on over the last couple days.
Joan Biskupic, Supreme Court reporter for USA Today and author of Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. Turning to you now, Stuart Taylor, do you expect Sonia Sotomayor to be confirmed?
Oh, there's no doubt she'll be confirmed. As Senator Lindsey Graham said up front, unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to be confirmed. So this debating and questioning goes more to what kind of justice she's going to be, appealing to the American people, both sides appealing to the American people as to what kind of judges we want.
What has stood out for you the most during these confirmation hearings?
Well, just in terms of the American people getting to know Judge Sotomayor, she comes across pretty well, I think. She's smart, confident, likable, unintimidated. She's also been, and I think quite deliberately in her testimony, rather bland and kind of seventh grade civics lecture style in terms of explaining how she approaches the function of judging. Some liberal law professors have pronounced themselves to be very upset that she's not kind of out there flying the flag of progressive jurisprudence. She's definitely not. She could be Judge Alito 3 years ago from the kind of testimony she's giving. I've been struck by the Republicans, I think, in terms of her case law. 3,000 decisions don't have a lot to work with. It's a fairly mainstream record. I think the Ritchie decision, they have something to work with, the firefighter reverse discrimination case. I think their effort to create problems for her on gun controls is kind of a losing battle, because I don't think she's done anything very significant on gun control. What they have done is they've fixed on her speeches. Between 93 and over about a 10-year period, she gave five speeches, I think, in which they were almost all identical. She talked about the wise Latina woman would make a better judge than a white male. And they are concerned that this shows some kind of agenda.
Stuart Taylor, let me stop you right there, and let's hear the exchange between Sonia Sotomayor and Senator Patrick Leahy on that very issue.
I want to state up front, unequivocally and without doubt, I do not believe that any ethnic, racial, or gender group has an advantage in sound judging. I do believe that every person has an equal opportunity to be a good and wise judge, regardless of their background or life experiences.
Marcia Greenberger, did she settle the issue of her wise Latina statement?
I think she settled the issue for those who were willing to allow her to explain it. But I think because the question got getting asked over and over again, there were some who simply wouldn't be satisfied with any explanation or any response that she could give. And I think that was something that came across quite clearly as this issue kept being, I would say, relitigated or raised over and over.
What do you think of her record thus far? What do you think of her appearance before the Judiciary Committee?
Well, in many ways, I think that her appearance was consistent with her record. It's a very careful, fact-based, very specific kind of record that many, many different people who have reviewed it from all kinds of angles have come to, in essence, the same conclusion about. And that is, she is bound by prior precedent and law. She's very, very methodical in the way she describes the facts and applies the law to it. She doesn't stray in her writing to talk about broader issues than the case presents itself. And in many respects, that's the way her testimony was. What really struck me about her, to amplify what Stuart and Joan said, is how knowledgeable she is about a broad array of legal issues. The grounding that she has in the law because of her 17 years on the bench, and also the wide experiences she had as a prosecutor and in private practice before, and that really showed itself in her ability to address in a very knowledgeable way all of the issues that were asked of her. And then the other thing that struck me was her confidence. Her demeanor was calm, for sure, very assured and very confident in herself and her capacity. And that, I think, was one of the things that was the most impressive to me about her.
Marcia Greenberger, she's founder and co-president of the National Women's Law Center. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8255. 8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Stuart Taylor, you have said you're having kind of a hard time figuring Sonia Sotomayor out. Tell me why.
I have the same problem Senator Graham, who I mentioned, has. If you look at her decisions, and that is what you usually look to in terms of what kind of judge is this, what kind of justice would she be, 17-year record, it's an impressive record of solid judging. There's nothing radical in the flavor. It's mainstream. I'd say it's left to center, as Senator Graham said, but what would you expect from a Democratic president? Of course, it's left to center. Then you look at her speeches. And there's a lot of lines in the speeches. They're somewhat ambiguous, such as the wise Latina woman quote. I won't quote the whole thing unless you really want me to, Diane.
No,
that that flatly contradict her testimony and that suggest more of the kind of liberal agenda that the Republican senators are worried
about.
Tell
me why you say that. Help me to understand that.
Why I say flatly contradict?
Yes.
Well, then I'm going to have to read it.
All right. Go ahead.
I would hope, compared to the clip you just played, I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better, I stop to say, not different, better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. That flatly contradicts the testimony she gave, and she said it at least five times.
Stuart Taylor, senior writer with the National Journal, contributing editor at Newsweek, and co-author of Until Proven Innocent. We'll take just a short break, be back for your calls, more clips, and you. If you've just joined us, Joan Biskupic is a Supreme Court reporter for USA Today. Marcia Greenberger is founder and co-president of the National Women's Law Center. And Stuart Taylor is senior writer at National Journal Magazine. And Stuart, just before the break, you were talking about why you are having such a hard time figuring out Sonia Sotomayor, because as you read her statement regarding the wise Latina, you said that her testimony yesterday and the day before totally contradict her.
That's correct. I think it does. I mean, the listeners have heard the testimony and they heard the statement. Basically, I think the core of the contradiction is the statement suggests that a wise Latina would make a better judge than a white male. And the testimony says that she intended nothing of the sort. She didn't intend to differentiate among ethnic or gender groups in terms of who would make a good judge.
And she did, part of the clip we did not play was that she said she has made the statement some eight times. If it were in her power, she would have toned it down, Joan Biskupic.
Well, what she said is that she actually was not talking about the judicial context of interpreting cases. What she told senators was that she was trying to inspire the Latinas, the Latinos in her audiences to say, you can come sit where I'm sitting. And she said that often at the end of these speeches, she would say, I hope I see you in court. I hope I maybe see you sitting next to me. And she did. I have to say that when you look at the groups that she spoke to, she really is speaking to folks from her community. She's speaking to people on the ground. She's not doing a lot of highbrow legal conferences. She's more speaking to Hispanic groups, to women's groups. And she casts this as being more aspirational, inspirational than an approach to judging. Now, one thing I'd say to Stuart is I can understand where the skeptics are coming from, but when you scrub those hundreds of rulings from the Second Circuit and from the trial court, you really don't see a sign of this. Now, I do think there's a legitimate question of what will happen now that she's when she's on the Supreme Court, because you're not under the yoke of the sort of precedent from the Supreme Court in the same way as the lower courts are. She would have hit the top of her ambitions and aspirations herself. She might use her position in a different way, and I think that's where the worries come from. But if you look at her record, there really isn't the kind of contradiction that would be implicit in what Stuart is saying.
Marcia.
Yeah, let me make just a couple very quick points. First of all, I think in talking about five speeches and one line in five speeches that we've heard over and over again, and especially as you pointed out that this was something she said given the reaction that she didn't see when she was giving those speeches, of course, but now she's hearing people reacting to. Then she said this was not what she had intended. It wasn't what she thought she was getting as a reaction for those in the audience. So I do think, as Senator Spector said, it's making a mountain out of a molehill to start with. But I want to make one other point, too, and that is the context of the speech, not only who she was speaking to, but where we are as a country. Right now, the number of Hispanic women judges in federal courts is less than a handful, basically, on the Court of Appeals to begin with. So for a Latina and her perspective, and I think there is a fair amount of consensus that a diverse court is a stronger court. And a court is better for having diverse experiences and diverse voices. So one could argue that she shouldn't have said a woman versus a man. But it is true that a court and the Supreme Court will be better for her perspective, and that the group decision, the court's decision, will be better for the fact that her life experiences are part of the mix in deciding a case.
All right, I want to move on to another issue that certainly came up, and that is abortion. We have a small clip, her exchange with Senator John Cornyn.
On what basis would George Pavia, who was apparently a senior partner in the law firm that hired you as a corporate litigator, on what basis would he say that he thinks support of abortion rights would be in line with your generally liberal instincts? He's quoted in this article saying, quote, I can guarantee she'll be for abortion rights, close quote. On what basis would Mr. Pavia say that, if you know?
I have no idea, since I know for a fact I never spoke to him about my views on abortion, frankly, on my views on any social issue.
Do you agree with his statement that you have generally liberal instincts?
If he was talking about the fact that I served on a particular board that promoted equal opportunity for people, the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, then you could talk about that being a liberal instinct in the sense that I promote equal opportunity in America and the attempts to ensure that. But he has not read my jurisprudence for 17 years, I can assure you. He's a corporate litigator, and my experience with corporate litigators is that they only look at the law when it affects the case before them.
Joan Biskupic, talk about how abortion has come into this discussion and has sort of come in sideways. It's come in from the top down. Talk about that.
Sure, Diane. And this is a decades-old controversy at Supreme Court nomination hearings. And right now, it's even more controversial for this reason. We have five justices, five among the nine, who have voted to uphold Roe v. Wade, the 1973 landmark that made abortion legal nationwide. But then we have a different five, with Justice Anthony Kennedy swinging from one group to the other, that has voted to uphold more government regulation on abortion, most recently to allow the federal ban on the procedure that critics call partial birth abortion. So this is a very compelling question for the senators and for the court, and likely will recur. And what the Senate Judiciary Committee obviously wants to know is where she falls. And this doesn't come just from senators such as Republican Kyle of Arizona, but also from the other side, from Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from California, who want to know where she is. She has not ever ruled on Roe v. Wade, and her abortion-related opinions are very much on the fringe. She gave them nothing. I have to say there was one exchange that I thought was in a very, very small way illuminating, but I emphasize small, and that was the day before to Senator Feinstein, where the senator wanted to know how she regarded a 2007 case in which the Supreme Court upheld the federal ban on so-called partial birth abortion without an exception for the mother's health. And Judge Sotomayor said she sees that decision as part of a continuum that includes other precedent of the court that would still allow or still require courts to look for a maternal health exception in a broader way. And Senator Feinstein seems satisfied with that, again, from the opposite point of view than some of these Republicans. But we did not learn much.
You know, Stuart, I was interested in Senator Cornyn quoting Mr. Pavia about Sonia Sotomayor's so-called liberal leanings. How does that get into the discussion? I mean, it seems to be sort of gossip. It struck me that way.
I don't think it was the best question Senator Cornyn ever asked the liberal leanings. And what would you expect again from a liberal Democratic president? You're going to get a justice with liberal leanings. I think he was going around that, Ben, because nominees, the last seven, and including Judge Sotomayor, have all refused to give even a hint of what they would do on that. I think Justice Ginsburg actually gave some hints, but she'd done that in prior writings. And so if you've written something, you obviously can't pretend you didn't. In fact, her testimony is almost indistinguishable from that of Samuel Alito, and John Roberts 3-4 years ago. There's a reason for that, two reasons. One is political. Anything you say on abortion is going to get somebody mad at you, so say nothing. But the other is more legitimate, I think. It's ethical. As Roberts said when he was resisting these kinds of questions, if I start down the road of answering your question, Senator, we're going to get into a bargaining process where you're saying, if you want my vote, you've got to say X, and I'm trying to decide, okay, I'll give you X, Senator, but I won't quite give you Y, and that would compromise the integrity and independence of the court, because once I get on there, if I get on there, then I'm going to have a list of campaign promises people are going to expect me to keep.
What about the role of empathy in this entire judicial process, Marcia?
Well, let me just say one quick thing about the abortion question, and then move to empathy. I think, though, you know, there's a lot of reading tea leaves in this instance, both because she doesn't have a record that explicitly addresses Roe and because the answers were basically the similar answers to what had been given before. Where the real distinction lies for somebody like me who was listening so intently to the specific choice of words, I did see a difference, and the difference that I saw between her answers and Alito's answers and Roberts' answers is that I didn't see the kind of hedging, even with the refusal to answer, that I saw in Roberts and Alito, where they talked about things like, I don't have a quarrel with this precedent. And then later on in their testimony admitted that what sounds like, oh, then I think it's fine, what they meant was, I haven't reviewed it yet, so I don't have a quarrel with it quite yet. But I could have a quarrel with it the minute I get on the court. She didn't use those kinds of hedge words, number one. And number two, when she and the Dianne Feinstein exchange talked about the woman's health exception, which is so fundamental to Roe v. Wade, and now at such risk because of a recent Supreme Court decision, and said to the senator that she thought that was still a vital precedent of the court, that to me was a very, very important exchange. And I frankly would not have seen or expected that kind of exchange with either Alito or Roberts. Now, with respect to empathy, again, I think that, like this Latina woman thing, has been blown completely out of proportion. Of course, it wasn't her word to begin with. And during the testimony, she said that ultimately, in her view, she decides cases on the basis of the facts and the law. And while she didn't disagree with the idea that being able to relate to the different parties is important and bringing real life experience is important, she wasn't embracing the concept of empathy herself. So while there might be objections to the president in his use of that term, she really was not embracing it for herself.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Dianne Rehm Show. On that point of empathy, Deborah Tannen, well-known author about emotions, relationships, she writes, "The suspicion of women's emotions and the stigmatizing nature of associating women with emotions goes way back. It was funny, I thought, that one of the senators was hammering her to give her personal opinion on an issue when she kept insisting that what matters is the law. He finally belted, "What does your gut say?" or something like that. Of course, had she said anything about her gut, it would have reinforced that stereotype suspicion about women being too emotional. And finally, the accusation that she is angry and difficult, I couldn't come up with the exact words, is also no doubt the reaction to her being professional. Many women are expected to smile and be soft when they are simply serious and appropriately tough. They are often seen as angry. Here's an exchange between the nominee and South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
"Now, let's talk about you. I like you, by the way, for whatever that matters. Since I may vote for you, that ought to matter to you. One thing that stood out about your record is that when you look at the almanac of the federal judiciary, lawyers anonymously rate judges in terms of temperament. And here's what they said about you. She's a terror on the bench. She's temperamental, excitable. She seems angry. She's overly aggressive, not very judicial. She does not have a very good temperament. She abuses lawyers. She really lacks judicial temperament. She believes in an out of control. She behaves in an out of control manner. She makes inappropriate outbursts. She is nasty to lawyers. She will attack lawyers for making an argument she does not like. She can be a bit of a bully. When you look at the evaluation of the judges on the Second Circuit, you stand out like a sore thumb in terms of your temperament. What is your answer to these criticisms?"
"I do ask tough questions at oral argument."
"Are you the only one that asks tough questions in oral argument?"
"No, no, not at all. I can only explain what I'm doing, which is when I ask lawyers tough questions, it's to give them an opportunity to explain their positions on both sides and to persuade me that they're right."
Joan Biskupic, Lindsey Graham said, Sonia Sotomayor stands out like a sore thumb. What was your reaction?
Well, that's not exactly true, frankly. The Second Circuit, where she sits, is known as a hot bench. Very active, aggressive questioning from that bench, and not so much unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, where Chief Justice John Roberts and Antonin Scalia are very much in there with a lot of give and take. So that struck me one thing. The other issue is these are anonymous reviews by lawyers, and later in the questioning, a friendly senator, a Democrat, started listing all the positive comments she had gotten. A couple things. There is an issue, as you mentioned, of some people feeling that women might be better in a softer place than more aggressive from the bench. And I think there were some concerns by some of her early critics or early defenders about any kind of ethnic stereotyping that might be coming in there with a concern for a hot personality. But I have to say that any provocative nature she has was shown to be the contrary because she didn't overreact at all to what Senator Graham said.
Joan Biskupic of USA Today. When we come back, it's your turn. We'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org, by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse, and by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Much of modern-day economic theory is based on the belief that investors behave rationally and markets are always right. The current economic crisis throws that assumption into question. The rise and fall of the rational market theory, the Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. It's time to open the phones, hear your thoughts, your questions, comments. First, let's go to Janesville, Wisconsin. Good morning, Mitch. You're on the air. Mitch, are you there? Okay, let's try New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. As you know, the Ritchie case was here in New Haven. And Mr. Ritchie initially was hired by the New Haven Fire Department after he filed an ADA lawsuit. So he's a member of a group with disabilities who got hired as some sort of affirmative action or equal opportunity under circumstances related to those. And he's also a civil servant, and neither of those groups is beloved by Republicans. So I just hope that Mr. Ritchie realizes that he is not somebody that Republicans have a lot of affection for, but he's just a pawn for them, a tool to be used to beat up Judge Sotomayor.
You know the case that he's referring to.
People for the American Way surfaced this, and Senator Hatch denounced them for it. Apparently, Mr. Ritchie, at some point when he was not hired by the New Haven Fire Department, filed a lawsuit for disability discrimination, and that eventually he ended up being hired. There was some kind of settlement. I don't know that that makes him an affirmative action hire. I'm not sure that a lot of the judge's supporters would say you're an affirmative action hire if you filed a lawsuit. But that's going to be some of the ammunition that's used against him. I think it's interesting that another firefighter, Ben Vargas, who's the Hispanic plaintiff in the lawsuit, is also going to testify, and I think he'll be very interesting to watch.
All right, to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Cedra. You're on the air.
Hello. I just have one comment.
Certainly.
About the Sotomayor hearings. I think that I can understand why the conservatives are questioning her, but I think that we also have to question our judgment as well, because what she's saying is that she's made better decisions because of her heritage, but based on the makeup of the court, that's what white men have said all along, just based on the makeup of the court. And so I think that they're saying that it's wrong for her to feel that way, but it's okay for them to feel that way.
Joan Biskupic.
Your caller makes an interesting point and a true point, because other nominees who've come before Judge Sotomayor have said the same thing about their personal backgrounds influencing them and making them more aware and understanding. And we know from experience and seeing rulings and talking to justices after they rule that even though they always say, and I believe they always try to rule on the facts and the law, that they can't help but be influenced by what they've learned about their own families, their own experience. I think this is all part of human nature, although the bottom line is that the ruling is based on the law and the facts of the case, but you're certainly, your eyes are opened and enlightened by your personal experiences. And one other thing that just occurred to me with that the caller's comment is that the justices get, with each case, amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, from all sorts of individuals who are not parties to the case, but whose lives could be affected by it, or their organizations could be affected by it. And what they try to do is bring life experiences before the justice to say, this is how this will affect me, which is all part of how things are resolved.
Stuart.
Yes. Well, this goes to the difference between saying, on the one hand, of course, all of us are influenced by our personal backgrounds and we're prisoners of our own thoughts, and maybe our backgrounds contribute something, which is uncontroversial and which is what the prior nominees have said, and saying, on the one hand, maybe impartiality is just an aspiration and our personal background is really more important in some ways and should be more important, which her speeches did. And also saying my personal background makes me better than your personal background makes you. That's what's controversial about her speeches.
And I really don't think I have to take issue with what Stuart said, because I really don't think that is what the judge was saying. I think that, first of all, what she was saying was not at the cost of impartiality. What she was saying was, when you look at facts and are evaluating a case before you, it is important to look and understand it from your own background, but then you also have to examine and make sure that you are not ultimately deciding it in any prejudicial way. And that is, of course, why that statement ultimately can be reconciled with a record that shows over and over again that there was no bias in the way she dealt with discrimination cases and the like, many studies that have pointed that out. But also, to go back to the caller's question, we know that there's a case that now has gotten a fair amount of attention that the Supreme Court just decided, of a 13-year-old who was strip-searched in high school because there was concern about whether or not she had some, I think it was ibuprofen. In the questioning, some of the male justices were poo-pooing the idea that a 13-year-old girl who was strip-searched would be suffering any kind of humiliation as a result of that kind of experience. And they were bringing to bear, in hearing the facts, an assumption that it's no big deal. And it would fail to Ruth Bader Ginsburg to talk about how a 13-year-old girl, frankly, in taking her, having to have a strip search and taking her top off, was going to have a very different experience than a 13-year-old boy.
All right. Here's an email from Steve, who's in, let's see, West Palm Beach, Florida, who says it's particularly galling to hear Senator Jeff Sessions to, in effect, accuse the nominee of racism. Sessions' nomination to the federal bench was rejected by the Senate in 1986 after disclosure of his history and statements about race, for example, that he, quote, used to think the KKK were okay until he found out some of them were pot smokers, or that he regularly addressed an African-American lawyer who worked for him as boy and told him to be careful what you say to white folks. Sessions also referred to the NAACP and the ACLU as un-American and communist-inspired because they forced civil rights down the throats of people. Stuart.
I've read those allegations that Sessions said those things. I haven't investigated what he said or whether he disputes them or what the story is. And therefore, I'm not going to kind of get into an examination of whether Senator Sessions is a racist or not. I would point out that he has not ever used the word racist or anything like the word racist in his criticisms of Senator Sotomayor, a couple of Republicans, outrageously, in my opinion, Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh, called her a racist. And the Republican senators, I think all the ones I've heard speak on the issue, have properly denounced them for it. The issue isn't whether she's racist. The issue is whether she has a double standard she might apply in the law. That's what they're worried about.
All right. And to Linda in Utica, New York, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. A comment similar to the one previously. I have found it such a ridiculous contradiction to hear Jeff Sessions just hammer this woman about the need for fidelity to the law and impartiality when he happens to represent a state and a part of the country that used the law clearly in a discriminatory way for years and years and years. And when the Supreme Court in the Brown versus the Board of Education case finally demanded that the law be applied impartially, the South went along with it, kicking and screaming to this day. The contradiction is just appalling.
Joan.
Well, you know, it is amazing. These Supreme Court confirmation hearings always occur in such a large context, in a context that stretches back decades. I have to say that we haven't seen the kind of really heavy-handed badgering this time around that we might have seen in other hearings. And Jeff Sessions, the Republican from Alabama, certainly has spoken openly about his rejection in 1986 by the Senate for a federal judgeship, and then he got elected in 96 to the Senate. And he said that that experience has made him want to be fairer in these. And he has been quite skeptical and critical of the nominee and probably won't vote for her, but she has not withered under the treatment that the Republicans have been giving
her. Stuart, let me ask you about this question of judicial activism and how you heard Sotomayor speak on this issue.
Well, judicial activism has been a Republican charge to hurl at Democratic nominees for decades, and it's in her case, I think it's not a wise charge to make, because if you look at her judicial record, none of the things that I think of when I think of judicial activism, and that people define it differently, jump out of her judicial record. I think they've just, it's sort of a mantra for them, and now the Democrats are hurling judicial activism charges back at the Roberts Court. So she said, I don't use words like that. I don't think of myself that way. Those were perfectly appropriate answers. I think the Republicans should just cancel judicial activism from their vocabulary for the remainder of this proceeding and talk about real issues.
Such as Second Amendment, Stuart.
Well, I think that's another kind of wrong tree the Republicans are barking up. Earlier this year, she had a case in which the issue was whether the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms applied as against the states or whether it just applies against the federal government. And she held that based on 19th century Supreme Court precedent, it does not apply against the states. And she's been criticized because more recent Supreme Court precedent seems maybe to reopen the question. I think her decision was a perfectly logical application of what the Supreme Court has said a lower court judge should do in a situation like that. And to reinforce it, two highly respected conservative judges in Chicago, Posner and Easterbrook, basically cited her decision and came to the same conclusion in a similar case.
I think I just want to say that I do think that there's a lot of barking up of wrong trees that really don't make very much sense because there isn't a lot, obviously, to really criticize her about. And that, I think, is part of why we keep hearing over and over again the same very few issues, because there's virtually nothing in her record. Her speeches, we're talking about one line in five speeches, given how many years and how many speeches she's given, that we're hearing over and over again. And even in those speeches themselves, she talks about how important it is to be ultimately impartial in looking at the facts and applying the law. And so none of these things have real merit. And I think that it puts those Republicans in a tough bind because they don't have a lot to deal with. And I don't think they're serving their cause well or the issues well to continually harp on them.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Dorothea in Norwich, Connecticut. Good morning. You're on the air. I'm sorry, it's Vermont. Dorothy, are you there?
Hello. Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I am very upset about the format of these hearings. I think it's a judicial hazing. And the requirement that they be approved by the Senate should certainly be done by a simple question and answer procedure and giving them a minimum amount of time. Prefacing it by all these statements by the senators is really a waste of time and taxpayers' money because it's just grandstanding.
What do you think, Joan?
Well, the hearings are a relatively new phenomena when you think of the whole span of more than two centuries. But it is one time when we get a chance to see a nominee who, if confirmed, is going to go to the cloister of that white marble building and then speak only through his or her written opinions. So I agree that there are flaws in this process and that we're not really seeing what kind of judge she would be, but it is at least an opportunity to see her and hear her speak.
Stuart. Go ahead, Stuart.
I was interested that three of the Democratic senators, Senators Schumer, Durbin, and Klobuchar, all went out of their way to compliment their Republican colleagues on basically asking fair questions and conducting a dignified hearing. That's rather unusual. And in fact, I'd say Judge Sotomayor is getting a lot less of a hazing than many previous nominees have got, including Roberts and Alito.
On the other hand, one caller has said Senator Graham was verbally abusing her and said it was very upsetting to watch.
I've heard that criticism that there was a very unpleasant and, in a certain sense, treating her in a somewhat demeaning way in the way he pursued that. But I have to say I have a fair amount of sympathy both in terms of the statements and in terms of the length of the process, even though in this instance I don't think there's a whole lot to explore about her record. So it does seem to be abusive in some respects. But I think to pick up on what Joan said, given that we're talking about a lifetime appointment, this is also an opportunity for these senators to tell someone who will be in the other branch of government and in essence beyond the ability to talk back and forth for the rest of her lifetime, the issues that are of concern to them. The way the court has approached issues of, for example, respect for congressional findings and legislation and review, which is the subject of some of their statements. So I think even though it may seem as if there's a ritual to it and in that it is taking a long time, and it's awfully repetitive, and I think all of that is true. I think there are some underlying good purposes to it. But also, I think, given going back to this wise Latina woman statement, which is getting so much play because, as I said, I don't think there's a whole lot else to talk about with her, and that KKK statement of Senator Sessions, I don't think the point of the statement is that he's a racist or not a racist. I think the point is people can make statements that are heard by others in all kinds of different ways that are unfortunate.
We
saw in the hearing, whether it was Senator Graham or actually a comment that Senator Coburn made about Ricky Ricardo, which I think caused a fair amount of concern, or other statements that people have made that hit people the wrong way.
All right, and one last question from Keith. I'm wondering if any of your panelists know how many male nominees have been questioned as to whether or not they bully the lawyers before them. 2 seconds, Joan.
I've gone through almost all the transcripts from recent hearings, and I've never heard the question before.
Joan Biskupic, Marcia Greenberger, Stuart Taylor, thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.